So I have a question for all of you teens here today. Actually, it's a question that everybody can answer. I want it to go directly toward the teens. But I think everybody, no matter how old you are, can place yourself back when you were a teenager for this particular question. I've had some fun at camp over the years with this question, but it's been a long time since I've asked it. So I'll ask it specifically of the teens here. If Jesus had not been born roughly 2,000 years ago, but instead had been born 16 years ago and lived in your neighborhood, went to your high school, was in your congregation, would all the kids like him? Would the kids at school like him? We don't have much history of his teen years, actually none. There's nothing to indicate whether he stood out with exceptional good looks or average looks. In particular, there's nothing about whether he had a lot of money or was a poor or middle income. Doesn't tell us much about his family status or his popularity or his power or his position as a teenager. So you sort of have to draw your conclusions from other hints in the Bible, or maybe from your own speculation, or maybe you can just use some logic to come to a certain conclusion. We are told, for example, that at age 12, his parents let him travel with some other people. At least that's what they thought he was doing. And when they found out he wasn't with them, they went back and they found him in the temple talking with teachers, asking questions. And at that time, he already understood that his calling was to be about his father's business. You can conclude from that he was pretty smart, because the teachers were marveling at the questions he was asking of them. So what does that mean? Was he just a brainiac? What was he smart in? What was it like? Well, they take him back home. And when you think about it, he had to live. He lived an everyday life. He grew up for all those years before he entered his ministry. And actually, his life ended at the time that we would call today a young adult. He was a young adult when his life came to an end and he had fulfilled his purpose. He wasn't that far removed from his teen years. So what was he like? And again, if he was living in our society today, would he be liked? What would the teachers at school think about him? What would the parents in your neighborhood think about him? If he got a summer job at Target, what would his bosses and co-workers think about him? He had a real life as a teen, lived in a town, had relatives, had peers, had friends, mixed with people all the time. How would he dress? What music would he listen to? What would he do after school? Would Jesus have ever gone to the park after school and gotten in a pickup game of basketball and shot hoops with other kids in the neighborhood? Would he be inclined to do that? If so, would he be the last one picked every time? Sort of the guy standing at the end of the bench, sort of the klutzy one, because he was just sort of what? Would he be the all-powerful, because after all, he was the Son of God? Could he dunk when he was 9? Could he outscore and outplay everybody just by turning on the juice a little bit because he had access to the Spirit of God in a physical way like that? What would he do? Or if he was at the picnic or at the park, would he be at the picnic table memorizing scripture verses, doing memory cards while everybody else played ball? I asked this one time at a summer camp, and I asked the question, would he play ball? And one of the campers said, no. I said, well, what do you think he would do? He said, well, he went to his room and studied his Bible every day after class, after school. I said, well, what makes you think that? Why would he be that way? Would he run cross country on the track team? And if so, how would he be as an athlete? Again, sort of like the basketball thing. Did he win every race? because if he was 100 yards behind with 100 yards to go, he could just turn on the afterburner and make sure he won? What would he have been like? Did he make straight A's without trying? Because after all, he knows everything. What would that have been like? Would he hang out after church? Would he go out with a bunch of his friends after church, go get a burger and go to a movie with the rest of you? What if he was here this weekend? Would he be so perfect and so goody-goody that he would be the type that all the mothers would be telling their kids, "Why can't you be more like Jesus? Mom, you know, he's perfect." Well, you know, what would it be like? If he lived in your community, went to your school, attended this congregation, would you like him? Would you like being around him every day? Would the kids at school like him? I want to ask for a show of hands. I've done this a couple of times before, and I know that there would be some yes, some no, some don't know. But hold your thoughts, whatever they are, for a while, and we'll come to a point a little bit later where maybe we can reach a conclusion. I have an opinion. I'll tell you what it is as we go on. But I think the answer to the question about Jesus being liked, or what makes someone you like to be around, or what makes you someone that other people like to be around, really boils down to one word. It's a powerful word. It's a much misunderstood word. It's a word that a lot of people find hard to use correctly. Sometimes people are even embarrassed to use the word. I've talked to people who said, you know, I never heard my parents say that word to each other. Or sometimes to even us kids. And yet it's a word that everybody talks about. It's on everybody's mind. It's a word we all need to hear expressed at different times, in different ways, in different contexts. We see a lot of people, children, teens, adults, who really need what that word describes and are not getting enough. I said it was in different contexts. I remember, for me personally, one of those contexts dealt with my relationship with females. Early on, when I was a teenager, I decided I would not use that word seriously with any female unless I knew she would say it back. That's the way I felt about it. Didn't take it lightly, but it is often used lightly. Sometimes you cringe when you hear it misused or used for the wrong purpose. Some people manipulate the emotions of other people by using this word. They do that to get what they want. And yet at the same time, it's such a powerful word. It's the word that describes what bridges the gaps in all relationships. Age gaps, generation gaps, cultural gaps, racial gaps, ethnic gaps. This is the singular thing that bridges the gaps. And it is a word that the people of God must center on and strive to understand and strive to implement. This word is mentioned 500 times in the Bible. 264 in the Old Testament, 236 in the New King James. So there's a huge emphasis on it in God's Word. Why? What is it all about? In fact, the Bible even says that this word is a summary of God. It's a summary of God, His way of life, His law, Himself. In God's Word, we also find a summary of God's plan of salvation for all of humanity, this great plan that He has implemented and put into place, in which we are a part of, and this word is the one word explanation of why He's doing all of this. It's a big word. I suspect you know what it is already. If you were at the Winter Family Weekend, remember the theme of that weekend, then you will know what it is. Now, I said it was a summary of His way of life. Let's go to Matthew 22, which talks about that. Matthew 22, verse 34. Matthew 22, 34. When the Pharisees heard that He had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And then one of them, a lawyer, asked Him a question, testing Him. and saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." The law of God is based entirely on this word and what it means. And he says it is a love. It's a love for God. It's a love for man. That one word I've been talking about is love. I said it's a summary of God. Quickly, let's take a look at those two scriptures, 1 John chapter 4. 1 John 4. 1 John 4 and verse 8. "He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." Well, that's a great statement. A lot of people talk about it, but what does that mean exactly? He repeats it in verse 16. "And we have known and believed the love that God has for us. God is love. And he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him." These are pretty bold statements. Now, when John was writing, he was an old man by this time. He'd been around for decades. I just find it interesting what he had come to after all these years of living, all these years of seeing people in the church and out of the church and watching them. He had seen good and the bad and the ugly. And when he wrote these three short letters, God inspired him to write some very strong words. And he just talks about this a lot, this concept of love, in chapter 2 and verse 5, 1 John 2, 5. He said, "Whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him." It's perfected in him. "And by this, we know that we are in him." You want to know if a person has a relationship with God? Look at the love that they have. Look at the love that they have. He said, look, living this way of life is all about love. And yes, it's a growth process. It's something that is perfected in someone. If you know, if you're really connected to God, you will see it in something about the way you live. In chapter 3, in verse 10, he said, "In this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest." So here's how you tell the difference. "Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother." There is a practicing of righteousness. In other words, doing the things that God says to do that are right. But then there's something about loving your brother too. Having this love for your brother. Who is your brother? We know that it's not just our siblings. It's our fellow man. In chapter 4, in verse 7, John goes to this point. He says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God." If you can learn to love, you can begin to understand some things about God, he says here. And then in verse 10, he says, "In this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins." So we know that love, to some degree, is sacrificial, has to do with an attitude of giving. And he says, it's not that we are the teachers of God or that we show the example. Everything that's right about love, we learn from God. "Beloved," verse 11, "if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another." Big word, powerful word. But what does that mean? In verse 20, John wrote this, If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. Whoa, that's pretty strong, isn't it? You're a liar, John said, if you say you love God and hate your brother. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? Strong words, though, those. Chapter 5, verse 1. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves him who begot also loves him who is begotten. In other words, if we love God, once again, he just words it a different way. We're going to love one another. And in verse 3, he says, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not burdensome. It's an interesting statement about keeping his commandments. One of those commandments, the original 10, one of them, was, we're told, is a sign between God and his people, the Sabbath. But it's not the only sign. It's not the only sign. It's extremely important to be sure. But the theme that we had at the winter weekend was also a sign. I've known people who kept the Sabbath and were very confident that they were God's people. But they just didn't really show a lot of love in a lot of cases, a lot of situations. There's more to it. The theme to the winter weekend came from John 13. Let's go back there and revisit this verse, John 13. Verse 34, John 13, 34. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. Now, loving one another was not new. You can go back to Leviticus 19, 18, and it says right there, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So that's not new, love one another. What is new about this, about what he was saying? He goes on. As I have loved you, that you love one another. Okay, that ratchets it up another notch. What used to be, okay, I'm going to try to love my brother. Christ says, no, you've got to love him the way I love him. As I have loved you, that's how you love one another. It's a level higher than the typical human has the ability to reach. Because it's a God level of love. How did God love us? How does he love us? We read that already. And then he says, this is the sign. Verse 35. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Now here's Jesus, the young adult, talking about this. How was he 15 years earlier in his life? How did he manifest it? What was he like? Well, again, this was the theme for the winter family weekend. By this, all men shall know that you are my disciples. We were in Portland this year instead of Louisville for the winter weekend. We had the same theme, the same seminars, or we had seminars and messages there too. And after listening to some of the messages and after preparing some of the messages, it once again confirmed to me that this is a topic that we don't hit it for a weekend and then go off on to the next interesting topic. This is something that is so deep and rich that we really need to think about it. So I decided to follow up on it here this weekend. Because from Christ's own words, this is it. There are doctrinal signs, there are belief signs that identify the people of God, but there are also behavioral signs. There are behaviors that identify whether it is really from the heart of God living in his people. So, what is this all about? Let's dig a little deeper. We've already covered some of the things that John said. There was a time earlier when the Apostle Paul also made it clear that understanding and accepting a doctrine is only part of the picture. It's an important part. But one of the great tests lies in a person's capacity to love. There's one place he wrote extensively about this. And he was writing to a congregation that was, they were struggling with this. They were stumbling in their ability to love. If you had been back in that area, you might have walked into that congregation to visit one Sabbath and might have left feeling a little disturbed or uneasy about some of the vibe that you got there. To this day, what do we use as a thermometer of the spiritual warmth of the church? We often talk about that, don't we? Well, that feels like a really warm, loving congregation. There are things that you pick up on. And the truth is, various congregations have always had varying degrees of love among themselves, just like people do. Just like you can look around and marriages and families and neighborhoods and work environments, some are a little more advanced than others on this. You could say very well that love is the main element in the chemistry of human relations. It's the main element in the chemistry of human relations. Well, we come to this time, and Paul has to write to this congregation. There were men and women, teenagers, children, young adults there. And what he wrote about was he was addressing a difficult subject. I'm sure it wasn't easy for him to write this letter. It's a complex letter. You can tell there was a lot of thought given to this letter and inspiration. How do you address these problems? And again, it's not unusual because it's part of the human condition. But Paul had the task of telling them, okay, here's a problem. Here's what needs to be done about it. And here is how to change it. This congregation had all sorts of problems dividing it. He opens this book in the very first chapter, right in the introduction, by asking the great question that is answered throughout the rest of the book. Is Christ divided? He points them to God, first of all, and to the head of the church, Jesus Christ. And the obvious answer is no, he's not divided. But they were. They were not an example of loving one another in ways that all would know that they were his disciples. Now, have you ever seen this play out in the church to one degree or another? Of course we have. We were transferred to Akron, Ohio in 1993. And I immediately found out that the teens in Akron did not like the teens in Canton. These churches were 30 miles apart. They knew each other very well, but basketball and cheerleading were times of some pretty serious competition and contention. The first Sabbath on the way home, we're driving home. My 12-year-old daughter sitting in the back seat. We're driving home. She says, "I don't like the Canton girls." I sort of turn around while keeping my eye on the road. "What do you mean you don't like the Canton girl? You don't even know any of the Canton girl." I don't like them. It hadn't taken but one Sabbath service for them to get to her. Here's the new kid in town, and we're going to tell her the way it is. And she had it in her mind, "I don't like the Canton girls." Well, that was a long historical thing. But it was there wasn't much love going on between these two groups of teenagers. There were problems. They might as well have been rival high schools. The two congregations might as well have been rival high schools because that's about the way it was. Now, here's the interesting thing. A year and a half later, we had our split from the Worldwide Church of God, major crack, and everything changed. We combined services then. We combined the congregations. And lo and behold, all of a sudden you're in the same church now. It's not them and us, it's just us. And as time went on, they began to get to know each other. And 3 years later, one of her best friends, that to this day remains a great friend, was one of those Canton girls. But it shouldn't have been like that in the church. But that's the way it was there. And so it was in Corinth, where Paul was writing this letter. The members there were acting, he said, like people act out in the world, just carnal. So first of all, he addressed and he explained some of the issues. They had their human philosophies that they were relying on more than God's word. There was immorality going on among some. Others were taking their brothers and sisters to court, suing them over things. There were those who had marriage problems. There were some who were eating meat sacrificed to idols in such a manner that was making other people stumble. Some of them were complaining about Paul himself. There were divisions in the way they were observing the Passover. There were different arguments over spiritual gifts. He just had to address several, quite a number actually, for one congregation, of big issues. But he comes to a point in his letter where he backs off of all those specific things and he takes the 10,000 foot view of life, the big picture. And he explains to them something. He said, you know, let me put it this way. I could stand up here and speak with the tongues of men and angels. I could be the greatest, most communicative personality in the world. He said, but if I don't have love, it's nothing. He said, I start sounding like a pair of cymbals that the guy in the band is just banging. It's just a lot of noise. He said, if I have the gift of all prophecy, if I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, have all knowledge, and I can know everything, and even if I had the faith that I could move mountains, if I don't have love, it's nothing. And then he said, if I give all of my goods to feed the poor, and if I give my body to be burned and don't have love, it's nothing. You might say, well, how could somebody give their life, give their body to be burned and it be nothing? Well, take a look at some modern day examples. Take a look at what happened this morning in Kabul, where somebody blows themselves up for selfish reasons. They kill scores of people, injure hundreds. It happened earlier in the week in Pakistan. It just happens all the time. People who sacrifice their lives for a selfish cause. Yeah, they give up their bodies for what they want. Take others with them. You might read this and say, okay, that's very good writing. It's very eloquent about love. But give me something practical. What does it look like? What does love look like in everyday use, in action, in practical, everyday terms? What is love? If we all sat around here and brainstormed, if I broke you into breakout groups and said, here's 15 minutes, go think about it and come up with a description. Come up with a description of someone who loves. What is it that they do? Or what is it that they don't do? What would you come up with? Think of another teenager here. Think of a teenager you know that's here in your congregation that's a really nice person. You think, well, you know, they're a pretty loving person. What would you identify of the traits that make them that way? What is it about them that makes them that way? Love is not just kind of some kind of fuzzy aura that's around them. You have to see something that makes you feel that. I think some things you could come up with would best describe what love is, and you would probably come up with some things that would best describe what it isn't. Here are the things that somebody does, and here are things that they don't do that you would say is love. But somebody who loves, just to give you a few things I think might show up on a list, would be, generally speaking, somebody who's positive about people. They think the best about people. They look for. Their basic outlook on life is to look for the best and see the best in people. Would you say that's something? What about somebody who's willing to be inconvenienced? They deal maturely when problems come up. What about someone who takes a stand for what is right? In other words, somebody would stand up for somebody who's being mistreated. Is that the kind of person you would say is demonstrating love? What about somebody who's just simply positive about life in general? How about somebody who is sensitive, highly aware of the needs of other people, and not so focused on their own needs, not self-absorbed? What about, would patience be on your list? Somebody who is patient, somebody who is, well, kind. Kind's a good one. You might say what love isn't. You might say, well, love, somebody who loves, they're not going to be the jealous kind. They're not going to be the envious kind. How about arrogant? Is somebody who loves, would you ever describe somebody who's arrogant as being a loving person? Probably not. Somebody who's not full of themselves, egotistical. Somebody who's not rude. Somebody who's not selfish. Somebody who's not touchy and moody and irritable. These are things you would probably come up with a list, and probably some other things too. Would you say those are pretty good descriptors? I hope so, because I didn't come up with them. God did. What I did there was just reword in a little different way Paul's description of love that God inspired in 1 Corinthians 13. Let's go there. 1 Corinthians 13. We already covered verses 1 through 3. Where Paul established that, hey, if I don't have love, it doesn't matter what else I have. All these other abilities, if I don't have love, because love is what will determine how you use those abilities. But he picks up in verse 4. He said, okay, here's what love looks like. Here's what love is. Love suffers long. In other words, it can put up with a lot. It's patient with people. It handles the mistakes of people in a mature manner. Doesn't say it ignores them. It just says there's a certain amount of an ability to suffer the loss, to turn the cheek, to take the loss if something is going to help someone else. Love is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It's not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely. Does not seek its own. It's not self-centered. It's not self-absorbed. It's not all about me. Love is not provoked. Love thinks no evil. Love does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Never fails. Okay, so when we read about love in the book of John, when we read about love in Matthew, when we read about love in those other, those 500 verses in the Bible, Paul is saying this is what it looks like. This is what it's like every day in somebody. This is what God is looking for. If you isolate each one of these things that are listed here, you might say, well, that's just a standalone. That's a character issue. You know, not being rude, that's just a character issue, and that's true. For instance, parents might teach their children not to be selfish. You try to teach your kids, don't be selfish, don't be rude. You train your child, say please. Say thank you. And we think of that probably first in terms of we're teaching them to be polite. But God says, no, it's bigger than that. Politeness is part of loving people. Politeness is an expression of your care for somebody else, your sensitivity to somebody else, your awareness of somebody else. You're going to be polite and not be rude because that's what other people need in life. That's the way we ought to be in life. It's a way to treat people, to see people, to appreciate people. When you're a parent teaching that, you don't teach them, say thank you, because you just want them, you want people to be impressed because, ooh, look how well-mannered your child is. No, you're teaching that because you're teaching them not to be rude. You're teaching them to be people who learned to love a little bit. So all of these things you can take and make them a standalone character issue and look at them and try to inculcate them, but they all go in this big bucket that is called love. This is what love is in action. Now let me ask you something else. Who do you like to be around? What kind of person do you like to be around? What kind of people are good for you to have as acquaintances? What type of people do you like to have as friends? Do you like to be around and to have as a friend somebody who thinks the best and sees the best in others? Or somebody is always picking apart other people, looking at the worst, pointing out their flaws, picking up on their negatives and their weaknesses? Would you rather be around somebody who will take a stand for what is right, or somebody who caves in when temptation comes along and tries to pull you in the same direction? Would you rather be around somebody who's willing to be inconvenienced and can put up maturely with problems, or somebody who's always whining when things don't go right because it disrupts their comfort zone? Would you rather be around somebody who can put up with a lot and doesn't get bent out of shape, or somebody who is short-tempered and tends to retaliate easily or is easily riled? You like to be around somebody who's positive about life or negative about life? Do you prefer to be around somebody who is sensitive about the needs of others or just highly focused on their own needs? Would you prefer to be friends with somebody who offends others easily, or somebody who is not easily offended? Would you prefer to be around somebody who is patient with you and your weaknesses and your inabilities and your mistakes, or somebody who's always critical and impatient with you? Would you rather be around somebody who is kind or somebody who is mean? Would you rather be around someone who is not envious or somebody who's very jealous? Do you prefer to be around somebody who's arrogant and egotistical and bragging about themselves all the time, or somebody who's humble? What kind of person do you like? Do you like to be around people who are rude or people who are respectful? People who are selfish or people who are giving and generous? People who are touchy and moody and irritable, or people who are peaceful and calm, slow to anger? Who do you like to be around? I think it's pretty obvious the type of person that people, at least most people, want to be around. I like being around people who behave, well. I like people who are like 1 Corinthians 13. That's the kind of people that you just like to be around. People who look like this. People who look like verses 4 through 8. Okay, let's go back to the original question. If Jesus had been born 16 years ago and was a teenager in your school, would the kids like him? Would the teachers, the parents, the neighbors, the co-workers like him? Well, what did he look like? Now, I don't mean his appearance. I don't mean you say, well, he's probably about 5'10 and stocky and brown-haired and, you know, brown-eyed. No, I'm not talking about his appearance. I mean, what did his behavior look like? How did he behave? How did he act in life? We don't have, again, much information about his teen years, but what you see in the Bible as a young adult is what you would have seen as a teenager. He was consistent. That's what he was. When you see him as a young adult in the Gospels, you don't see somebody who's arrogant, who's rude, who's selfish, who's egotistical, who's irritable. You see somebody who was caring, who was kind, who was patient, who was compassionate, who was positive, who was encouraging, who stood for right, who was moral, who was friendly. Would Jesus have been liked? You may say, well, that's your opinion, but my opinion is I think he would have been one of the most liked kids in school. I think people would have liked him. Now, that's not to say that everybody would have liked everything he did, I'm not saying everybody in the school wanted to hang out with him, but just as far as a person goes, would they have liked him? Was he an oddball? Was he goofy? Was he a religious nut? No, because real religion is outgoing. Real religion cares for people. Real religion, godly religion, behaves in a certain way. Did he hide in his bedroom reading the Bible every waking hour? The Bible shows that he loved being with people. He mixed with people all the time. And when he was with people, was he an exclusivist? Did he hang out only with his friends? Was he a snob? You don't find any evidence of that. He did have friends. He did have a group that identified with him that he tended to hang out with, but he was not exclusivist. In school, would he have sat down at the lunch table in the cafeteria and talked with the girl with purple hair? Would he? Would he have talked with the guy who had a chain that ran from his earlobe to his nostril? The Bible says he sat down to eat with publicans and sinners, and he got criticized for it by some people. He eats with sinners. And so he did. Now, would you see him with the guy with the chain running from his nostril to his ear? Would they be palling around together all the time? Maybe not, probably not. But how would Jesus have been toward him? Would he have talked to him? Would he have been friendly? How would he have treated him? Folks, he came to die for him. I suspect he would have treated him right. It's interesting when it said that he was accused of being a friend of publicans and sinners. The word friend is philos, P-H-I-L-O-S. And according to the dictionary, the biblical dictionary, it means friendly. Or it can mean an active friend. Thayer's dictionary says a friend, or to be friendly to one, or to wish them well. I'm not saying that he would be like them. I'm not saying he would run with their crowd. But how would he have treated them? How would he have treated them? I'm just saying that God is love. And he was God on the earth. And 1 Corinthians 13 is the way that he lived. And people, for the most part, like to be around those kind of people. They like people who behave right. Now you can say, oh, wait a minute. There were people who didn't like him. And that's true. He had his enemies. But it's interesting when you really read about it. One of the main reasons he had some enemies and people who did not like him was because so many other people did. Other people liked him and they got jealous. They were fearful that he was going to pull them away from their control over people. They were jealous because he was liked so much. Now let me give another qualification. People didn't always like it when he told them that they needed to change. People didn't always like what he told them that they needed to do and what he preached. But most people liked him. Think about it. If he was 16, how would he treat the unpopular, introverted kids at your school? The kids who are the wallflowers, the kids who have a little trouble fitting in. How would he treat them today? The kids who were poor, who were abused. Do you think he would be aware and be sensitive to them? Maybe go out of his way to say something nice, to help them out in some way or another? Would he have been a bully? No. Would he have defended the bullied? Would he have stepped up to defend the bullied? I'm pretty sure he would have. Would he have comforted the kids who were insecure? The kids who were too big, too large, or the kid who's too small, or the kid who is fearful, or backward, or shy, or clumsy, uncoordinated? the one who may be a little emotionally unstable, if there would be somebody in the school who probably cared, that would be him. That would be him. I think of a great example is how he broke one time, he broke all the norms of the day. He violated the cultural rules, and he sat down and talked at length with a Samaritan woman. And according to the culture, he should not have even been talking to a Samaritan in the first place, much less a woman. But apart from the interesting discussion that you can read that they had, you also read that he treated her with respect, with dignity, with honor, so much that she marveled at it. And she went back and told everybody in her village and talked about that. When you read the Gospels, you see that Jesus commonly healed people. Why? Was it to show off his power? Was he ever with the disciples and say, you see that guy just ran into the wall three times because he's blind? Hold my beer and watch this. Poof. Bet you wish you could do that, don't you? Did he ever do miracles to show off? Why did he heal people? It was an example of his heart, his attitude, his approach. There's a great example in Mark chapter 1. Let's go back here. Mark 1. Sometimes we read what he did, but it's good to stop and think about, okay, what was driving him? What was in his mind when he did this? What was his purpose? Mark 1, in verse 34, it reads that, then he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him. So he's healing a lot of people, and you could read this and say, well, you could read through the whole chapter here, and there are all sorts of miracles that he's done. It's easy to say, well, of course people would like him. Go around giving away free healings, and you'll have a lot of friends real quick. People love that sort of thing. But I think that people probably sensed there was something more to it than just he's giving out free healings. Because we come to verse 40, and there's a really interesting story here. In verse 40, it says, then a leper came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him, and saying to him, if you are willing, you can make me clean. It's interesting. The leper did not say, if you have the power. He just went straight to the heart, and he asked Christ, if you're willing to do this for me. Are you willing to do this for me? I know you can do it. And Jesus, moved with compassion, put out his hand and touched him and said to him, I am willing. Be cleansed. As soon as he had spoken, immediately the leprosy left him and he was cleansed. Now, today this disease is known as Hansen's disease. It's a highly infectious disease, leprosy. In the biblical times, it was basically incurable. It could be treated today with some degree of success, but in the Bible times, back here, there was no disease probably that was feared as much as leprosy. It affected the whole body eventually. It usually began with fatigue and pain in the joints, and then scaly spots would start coming up on your skin. And as the disease progressed, the body would be covered with nodules. I won't describe them because the description I read was not appealing in any way. It would eventually affect the appearance of the face. Your face would start to deform. The body was in a state of living decomposing. Living decomposition was the state of somebody with leprosy, and therefore there is a stench around lepers all the time. It usually ran its course over years and resulted in a very horrible, painful death. But one of the worst aspects of leprosy was that it made you socially isolated. You were socially isolated. Now, there's a Levitical law back in Leviticus 13, verses 45 and 46, that specifically addressed lepers, and it said that they had to be quarantined. They had to be removed from everybody else, and they had to be isolated because of the contagion factor. And it also says there in Leviticus that they would have to, if they were out among people, they had to warn people and cry, unclean, unclean, give them warning. That it was their responsibility. By the time we got to Jesus' day, the Pharisees had altered, as they had with so many laws, they had altered that one too, and they had added a lot of restrictions to the laws regarding lepers. They especially despised lepers, the rabbis did, because they saw them as people who were under a special judgment of God, and they deserved no pity or mercy. So a leper would be banned. They'd be put out of a village, no longer having communication or contact with other people. They had to leave their family, had to leave their friends. It was unlawful to approach at that time within 50 feet of a leper. He could not touch anybody. He could only see people from a distance. And when people were coming, the Levitical law said, you're to say unclean, unclean, but by the time the Pharisees had gotten finished with their restrictions, they were in a culture where people would often pick up rocks and throw rocks at the lepers, drive them away. They were looked down on. So he comes here. This is a really amazing step on his part to come. And it says he came to him and implored him and kneeled down. And Jesus doesn't throw any rocks at him. But it says that he, Jesus, was moved with compassion. He's moved with compassion. Compassion is a word defined as a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken by misfortune, accompanied by a strong desire to alleviate the suffering. Compassion is something that you want to do something about it. And so he did something very strange. We read over it quickly. It's easy to do, but let's read it again. Verse 41, moved with compassion, put out his hand and touched him. Put out his hand and touched him. Jesus didn't say, I'm willing, stand back, I'll send you an anointed cloth. Reached out his hand and touched a leper. Touched a leper. You ever thought about it? It might have been years since that leper had been touched by another human being. You know what it would be like? Have you ever thought about it? We walk in here today. I don't know. I hugged a bunch of people. Shook hands. Can you imagine going for years without not even being able to touch another human? Jesus could have healed him with a word. He could have healed him with a thought. He could have done it that way, but he healed him with a touch, because that's what that leper, he not only needed healing, he needed something more. It'd probably been years since this man had held his wife or children, because that was unclean. I suspect this man was surprised when Jesus reacted that way. I suspect everybody else who was there and saw it probably was shocked, because you did not do that. But how did it feel to that man? How would it have been to that man to have that happen to him? The point is, as you look through the Gospels at Jesus' life and you look at, okay, how is he expressing his care? How is he expressing love? You see over and over again that love is not just an emotional feeling. It's a way of behaving. It's things that we do. It's reaching a level of expression that most people don't reach. And it's a mind of God. It's part of the love of God for that. The love of God is based on a willful choice to be like Him and to strive to reach a higher level of behavior than what most people do. And it does require something special from God. To love your enemy is not natural for humans. That's hard. What's natural for humans is, I don't like the Canton girls. What's natural for humans is, that person's condition makes me really uncomfortable. I don't know if I can go there. But Jesus Christ was one who broke through all of that. It's hard sometimes. It requires work. It requires study, effort, dedication, prayer, studying, and then following Christ's example when it's difficult and when it's challenging. Studying and looking at the example of other people who have God's Spirit who are doing some of these things well and saying, I want to follow that example. I want to be like them. It's not easy. One of my favorite movie lines comes from the movie A League of Their Own. People remember seeing A League of Their Own about the women's baseball team in World War II? There's a point in there where the catcher, Gina Davis, is ready to quit. She comes up to the coach, Tom Hanks, one day, and she says, I'm going home. And he says, why? And she just says, it's just too hard. And he said, if it wasn't hard, everybody would do it. Christianity is hard. That's why not too many people do it. But with God's help, and the desire to see that this is the way to be, and to look around and say, at the end of the day, who do I want to be around? Who do I want to be like? How do I want to be? What do I want to look like? And that's the way I'm going to choose to strive to live. 1 Corinthians 14, the next chapter that follows, makes this brief little statement that two words tell us something. 1 Corinthians 14:1, pursue love. Pursue love. We must go after it. We must think about it, cultivate it, pray about it, and pray for it. Because this comes with God's help. And it must be pursued because it's not natural to a human being. But when you do, something changes in your life. As we do, the love of God changes hearts and minds. Some of you were in Hawaii at the feast. I told the story there, and I'll repeat it here, though. Some years ago, Dee and I were in another country for the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And I was conducting the Passover, and during the foot washing, it just happened. You just get up and you line up and you are paired off with whomever you're with. You don't walk in to the building that night and say, hey, I'll wash your feet if you'll wash mine. You just walk in and you're paired off with somebody. We'd never been there before. We didn't know anybody there. So I'm next to this gentleman. It was a middle-aged black man that I'd never met. We washed each other's feet as usual and proceeded on with the service. 2 days later, at the Holy Day, after services that afternoon, he came up to me and he said, I need to tell you something. Yes? He said, I was healed at the Passover. So what do you mean? He said, ever since I came in the church, my biggest struggle has been with hating white people. He said, I've struggled with that. I suffered a lot, he said, in my youth at the hands of some white people. And even though I've known it was wrong, it's been hard for me. He said, I've really struggled not to hate all white people. It's been a hard struggle. He said, but at the foot washing, I was sitting there in a chair, looking down, watching you, a white man, washing my feet. And he said, I just felt all those hard feelings just drain away. He said, I felt peace for the first time, and I know that God has healed me. That was remarkable to me. He was on his way to learning to love and to be loved at a level he had never been able to reach before. Now, I take no credit for that. I didn't even know what was happening in his mind. I was trying to focus on my getting out of the Passover, the lessons we're supposed to get out of it. But God was working in the mind of that man to make it possible. God was helping him to overcome his struggle and to reach a higher level and a capacity to learn how to love somebody else. Because his life had been damaged in that way. And he needed to get past that barrier. And that's what God's way teaches us. God's way teaches us that. As we keep the Passover, we learn about the love of God. We engage in that symbolic act of foot washing, and we often say, well, it's about learning to serve. But isn't learning to serve really learning to love? Learning to love people, to give yourself for them and to fulfill their needs. And then in our process of spiritual growth, if we're working to be like Christ. And the reason why I started out with an example of teenagers is because a teenager, you may not be baptized going to the Passover yet, but you can be deciding as a teenager to say, you know, that's the way I want to be. I see the logic in that. That's clear. And I see the distinction between my peers at school and the way we're supposed to be. And I'm going to work to do these things and to be like that. As we do that, we experience breakthroughs in life, just like that man did. We grow, we change. And it all comes from the love of God and through His Spirit and through living the way He tells us to live. You look around the world today, there are a lot of people just like that man, and some of them worse. So many people have been damaged and are hurting over things going wrong. People who want peace, they would just like to have peace in the world and peace in their lives. They want to see an end to all the strife. And there are many people who would genuinely want to do anything they could to bring that about. But any human's best efforts are very limited. There are some who, well, everybody picks off the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Some pick more good than evil. But it's still limited. It's still limited. Some pick what they think is good to them, but it ends up being the ways of death. Everybody talks about love, but we're not doing so well at it. We're not doing so well at it. That's why it is true love, godly love, that breaks down the barriers between God and man and between man and man, between us human beings. We've got a lot to learn about it. We have a lot to grow in, but I also know we're in the process, that God is helping us to do this. I'm also convinced the more you see and experience in life that Jesus was absolutely correct. By this, all men will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another. They have to see something different. I'm also convinced that now is the time to really be working on this, because we're mindful of Jesus' words in Matthew 24, when he said, at the time of the end, because iniquity will abound, what's going to happen? The love of many will grow cold. What does exist is going to lessen. Love of many is going to grow cold. And in a world where the love of many is growing cold, growing to love like God is your spiritual self-defense. It's a spiritual self-defense. It will protect you from going down that same road. We need that for spiritual survival. We need to love for spiritual survival. 1 Corinthians 13 tells us what love looks like. I began with the question. I'll end with the question. Do you look like love? This is what love looks like. Do you look like love? I look at my life and say, maybe in some things, yes, and some things, not so well. And that's where we all are. We have growth to do. We have to be working on it. We need to be growing in it. Let's be working together. You want some practical things to make your life different? Just take 1 Corinthians 13. That's a great place to start. That's a great place to start to work on very practical aspects of love. This is what love looks like. It's what Christ looked like. So have a great weekend. Enjoy your teamwork, as you heard in the sermonette, work on your basketball skills and your friendships and have good times with each other. But above all, use every opportunity in life to work on love, the love of God, so you can look like Jesus Christ.